Fasten your seatbelts, everyone. We're about to take off on a deep dive into the world of flight instruments.
And we'll be using the pilot training handbook chapter you provided as our flight plan.
It's like having a personalized pre-flight briefing.
Exactly.
We're going to decode those dials and gauges that help pilots navigate the skies.
It's more than just knowing what the needles are pointing to, though.
Right.
It's about understanding the systems behind them and why they matter so much for making safe decisions when you're up in the air.
So let's start our journey with the pitot-static system.
Okay.
Now, I know it might sound a little bit intimidating at first.
Sure.
But trust me, it's actually pretty intuitive once you wrap your head around it.
Okay.
Think of it this way. Imagine you're sticking your hand out of a car window as you're driving along.
Yeah.
You can feel both the air pressure and the force of the wind against your hand, right?
Right. That's right.
Well, that's essentially what the pitot-static system does for an airplane.
Right.
It gives pilots information about both altitude and airspeed.
It's a pretty ingenious system when you think about it.
It really is.
The pitot tube is the MVP of this whole system. It's
right.
Like a little sensor that sticks out from the front of the plane.
Okay.
And it captures two types of pressure.
Okay.
There's static pressure, which is basically the ambient air pressure surrounding the aircraft.
Okay.
And then there's dynamic pressure, which is generated by the plane's movement through the air.
Ah, okay. So it's like the difference between just standing still in the air and actually moving through it.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes sense. So tell me, how does the altimeter use this static pressure to figure out how high the plane is?
Well, it's based on the principle that air pressure decreases as you go higher.
Okay.
So the altimeter measures that static pressure.
Right.
And then it converts it into an altitude reading.
Gotcha.
So the lower the pressure, the higher the altitude.
Makes sense. But I remember reading in the pilot's handbook that temperature can really mess with those altitude readings.
You're right. Temperature plays a huge role in all of this.
How so?
Well, let's say you're flying along and you encounter a pocket of cold air.
Okay.
Colder than what you were expecting.
Okay.
Your altimeter is calibrated to what we call a standard atmosphere.
Okay.
So it might show you at a certain altitude.
Okay.
But because the air is colder than standard, you're actually much closer to the ground than you think you are.
Oh, wow. That's a bit unsettling.
Yeah, it can be a real hazard if you're not aware of it.
So how do pilots account for these temperature variations?
Well, that's where understanding the different types of altitude comes into play.
Okay, like what?
We use something called pressure altitude.
Okay.
Which is basically your altitude corrected to a standard pressure setting.
Okay.
But the real star of the show, the one that pilots really need to pay attention to,
yeah,
is density altitude.
Okay.
This takes both pressure and temperature into account.
Okay.
And it gives you a much more accurate picture of how your aircraft is going to perform.
So density altitude is kind of like the feels like temperature for airplanes. Is that right?
Exactly. It's a great way to think about it.
So just like how humid air can make 80 degrees feel like 90.
Right.
High density altitude can make your plane feel sluggish.
Yes.
Even if your altimeter is telling you you're at a perfectly normal altitude.
It's a bit counterintuitive, but yeah, that's how it works.
So why is density altitude so important for pilots, especially during takeoff and landing?
Well, think about it. When you're taking off or landing,
yeah,
your aircraft needs to generate enough lift to get off the ground or to slow down safely.
Right.
But if the density altitude is high,
yeah,
the air is thinner.
Okay.
Which means your wings have to work harder to produce that lift.
So it's like trying to run through mud.
Exactly. Your plane's performance is going to be reduced.
Okay, I'm starting to see how this density altitude thing is a pretty big deal.
It's definitely something that pilots need to be aware of at all times.
Yeah. Now let's get back to that pitot-static system for a minute. I know it also powers the airspeed indicator, right?
That's right. The ASI, as we call it.
The ASI.
It compares the static pressure to the dynamic pressure that's captured by that pitot tube.
Okay.
And that gives you your indicated airspeed. Or IAS.
IAS, got it. So that's what the pilot sees on the instrument panel.
Exactly.
But I've also heard terms like CAS and TAS thrown around. What's the difference between all these airspeeds and why should a pilot care?
Yeah, it can get a little confusing, but let me break it down for you.
Okay.
CAS stands for calibrated airspeed.
Okay.
And it takes into account instrument errors and position errors.
Okay.
So it gives you more accurate reading than just your raw IAS.
Okay.
But the real star of the show, the one that matters most for flight planning and things like that, is TAS, or true airspeed.
True airspeed.
And this is your actual speed through the air mass.
Okay.
Taking into account things like altitude and temperature.
So it's like CAS is the refined version of the raw data from the ASI, And TAS is the ultimate truth about how fast you're really moving.
That's a great way to put it.
So why is it so important for pilots to understand the difference between CAS and TSS?
Well, for one thing, TAS is what determines your actual speed over the ground.
Okay.
Especially at higher altitudes where the air is thinner.
Okay.
It's also crucial for things like flight planning and fuel calculations.
So if you're not paying attention to your TAS, you could end up running out of fuel before you reach your destination.
That's right. It's all about having a complete picture of your flight conditions.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, I've always been curious about those color-coded markings on the ASI. What's the deal with those?
Oh, those are really important. They're basically like a speedometer with built-in warnings.
Okay.
The green arc shows you your normal operating range.
Okay.
Yellow is a caution zone.
Okay.
And then you've got that red line at the very top.
Yeah.
That's your never exceed speed.
Uh-oh.
You don't want to go past that.
Why not?
Because you could risk serious structural damage to the aircraft.
Okay, so those colored arcs are basically like a visual reminder to the pilot about the safe operating limits of the aircraft.
Exactly. They're there to help prevent accidents.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, what happens if that pitot-static system gets blocked? I imagine that could be a pretty serious problem.
You're absolutely right. It's a major concern.
So I'm guessing those pre-flight checks are super important.
They're absolutely crucial. Even a small blockage can throw off your instrument readings and lead to dangerous situations.
What kind of things can cause a blockage?
Oh, all sorts of things. Bugs, ice, dirt, you name it.
Okay, so it's like anything that can get stuck in those tiny tubes.
Exactly.
So what happens if the pitot tube itself gets blocked?
Well, that could cause your airspeed indicator to show a decrease in speed.
Okay.
Even when you're actually accelerating.
Oh, wow. That sounds incredibly dangerous.
It is. It could lead to a stall.
Okay.
Which is basically when the airflow over the wings gets disrupted and you lose lift.
So it's like suddenly the wings stop working.
That's a good way to think about it. It's a very dangerous situation to be in.
So those alternate static sources that are mentioned in the handbook must be like a lifesaver in those situations.
They can be, yes.
Yeah.
It's all about having backup systems. Redundancy is key in aviation.
Okay.
But even with an alternate static source, the readings you get might not be as accurate as the primary system.
Okay, so you still have to be cautious.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's always important to be aware of the limitations of your instruments.
Right, okay. We've covered a lot of ground with this pitot-static system.
Yeah, it's a pretty complex system.
It is. But I think I'm starting to get a handle on it now.
That's great. It's a fundamental part of understanding how aircraft fly.
It really is. So are you ready to delve into something even more mind-bending?
Bring it on.
Okay. Let's talk gyroscopic instruments.
All right.
These instruments rely on the properties of spinning objects.
Yes.
It's pretty wild stuff when you think about it.
It is.
I mean, think of a toy top. You know, when you spin it?
Yeah.
It seems to defy gravity.
Right.
It doesn't want to tip over. It wants to stay upright.
It resists any attempt to tilt it.
Exactly. And that's what we call rigidity in space.
A pretty amazing phenomena.
So how do pilots use this concept to stay oriented up in the air?
Well, the heading indicator is a great example.
Okay.
It uses a spinning gyro to create a stable platform.
Okay.
That remains fixed even as the aircraft is turning.
So even though the plane is moving all around, the gyro inside the heading indicator stays put.
Exactly.
And that allows the pilot to maintain a consistent heading.
That's right. Even in clouds or at night when they can't see the horizon.
Wow. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So how does that gyro stay spinning?
Well, in older instruments, they used a vacuum system powered by the engine.
Okay.
But in newer aircraft, they often use electric motors.
Okay. So it's constantly being powered to keep spinning.
Exactly. It needs that constant spin to maintain its rigidity.
Makes sense. Now, I also came across this term precession while I was reading the pilot's handbook.
Ah, yes. Precession. It's a fascinating concept.
It sounds pretty complicated.
Well, it can be a bit tricky to wrap your head around at first.
Okay.
Imagine you're pushing on that spinning top we were talking about earlier.
Okay.
Instead of tilting in the direction you're pushing, it moves at a right angle to the force you're applying.
Oh, wow. That's not what you'd expect.
Right. It's counterintuitive, but that's precession.
So wait, that's how instruments like the turn coordinator work?
That's right. They use precession to show the pilot how fast the airplane is turning.
Okay.
And also the quality of the turn.
Okay. What do you mean by the quality of the turn?
Well, it can tell you if the turn is coordinated or not.
Coordinated?
Yes. A coordinated turn is one where the rudder and the ailerons are being used in harmony.
Okay.
So the plane is turning smoothly without any slipping or skidding.
Ah, Okay, so the turn coordinator can tell you if you're doing it right.
Exactly. It's a valuable instrument for pilots.
I can see why. So how does the pilot know if they are slipping or skidding during a turn?
Well, there's another instrument that comes into play here.
Okay.
It's called the inclinometer.
The inclinometer,
Okay, you've
okay.
probably seen it. It's that little ball in a tube.
Oh, yeah. The little ball that rolls around.
That's the one. Think of it like trying to balance a ball in a tube while you're turning.
Okay.
If the ball is centered, you're in a coordinated turn.
Okay.
If it's off center, then you're either slipping or skidding.
Okay, I get it. So the ball is like a visual indicator of whether you're using the rudder and ailerons correctly.
That's right.
It's amazing how all these instruments work together to give pilots a complete picture of the aircraft's movement.
It's all about creating a system of checks and balances.
It really is. Now, we've got the heading indicator, the turn coordinator, and the inclinometer,
Right.
but there's another crucial gyroscopic instrument we need to talk about, right? The attitude indicator.
Ah, yes, the attitude indicator is
Yeah.
another lifesaver.
Okay, so tell me, what does the attitude indicator do?
Well, it gives pilots a visual representation of the aircraft's orientation relative to the horizon.
Okay.
So even in low visibility conditions,
Yeah.
they can tell if the plane is level,
Okay.
climbing, or descending.
Ah, okay. So it's like an artificial horizon that the pilot can refer to.
Exactly.
So even in clouds or fog, they can tell which way is up.
That's right. It's essential for maintaining control of the aircraft in those situations.
I can see why. So how does the attitude indicator manage to stay accurate even when the plane is moving all over the place?
Well, it also relies on a gyroscope,
Okay.
but this one is mounted in a special way
Okay.
so that it remains level with the horizon.
So it's like the gyro is constantly fighting against the plane's movements to stay aligned with the horizon.
Exactly. It's pretty amazing engineering.
It really is.
Yeah.
And hasn't technology made these instruments even more precise and reliable in recent years?
Absolutely. We've seen some incredible advancements.
Like what?
Well, for example, the AHRS, or Attitude and Heading Reference System, is becoming increasingly common in modern aircraft.
Okay, the
It
AHRS.
replaces those older mechanical gyros with laser systems.
Wow, lasers.
Yeah.
Okay, so that means they're more accurate,
More accurate.
more reliable.
And they require less maintenance, too.
Ah, so it's a win-win all around.
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow, from spinning gyros to laser systems. It's amazing how technology has revolutionized these flight instruments.
It's really remarkable.
But of course, we can't forget about that trusty old magnetic compass.
Oh, the magnetic compass, a classic.
It might seem simple compared to all these fancy gyros and lasers, but it's still a vital tool for navigation, right?
Absolutely.
So remind me how it works again. It's all based on the Earth's magnetic field, right?
That's right.
The Earth is like one giant magnet.
Exactly. And the compass needle aligns itself with that magnetic field. It's a pretty simple concept, but it's been used for centuries to help people find their way.
It's amazing how something so simple can be so effective.
It is.
But I'm guessing it's not always quite as straightforward as just following the needle north, is it?
You're right. There are a few things that can make things a bit more complicated.
Like what?
Well, for one thing, we have to consider variation.
Variation.
Yes, that's the difference between magnetic north and true north.
Wait, so the compass doesn't actually point to the geographic North Pole?
Nope, it points to the magnetic North Pole.
And those two poles are in different places.
They are indeed. And the difference between them can vary depending on where you are on the Earth.
Okay, so that's variation.
Exactly.
But it gets even more interesting
Cortez.
because then there's this thing called deviation.
Right. And that's caused by the aircraft's own magnetic field.
Okay, so all that metal and wiring in the plane can create its own little magnetic field.
Exactly. And that can throw off the compass readings.
Oh, wow, I never thought about that. So how do pilots deal with all these magnetic gremlins?
Well, there are a few tricks up their sleeve.
Okay.
One of them is called a compass rose.
A compass rose, like the flower?
Not quite. It's basically a giant protractor that's painted on the ground,
Okay.
and pilots use it to calibrate their compasses.
Ah, okay. So it helps them figure out how much deviation their compass has.
That's right. And then they record that information on something called a compass correction card.
So it's like a cheat sheet for adjusting their compass readings.
Exactly. It tells them how much to add or subtract from the compass heading to get an accurate reading.
Wow, it's like having a personalized decoder ring for your compass.
That's a great way to put it.
But hold on, we're not done yet, are we? Because I remember reading something about dip errors, too.
You're right. We've only just scratched the surface of compass complexities.
Okay, so tell me about these dip errors. What are those all about?
Well, remember how the Earth's magnetic field isn't parallel to the surface at all locations?
Right, it dips downwards as you get closer to the poles.
Exactly.
So how does that affect the compass?
Well, it can cause the compass needle to tilt.
Okay.
Which can lead to inaccurate readings.
Especially during turns, right.
You got it.
Wow, so even something as seemingly simple as a compass can be a source of complexity in the cockpit.
It definitely can.
Yeah.
It's all about understanding the nuances of the instrument.
And how those nuances are affected by the plane's movements and the Earth's magnetic field.
Exactly.
It's like a constant puzzle that pilots have to solve.
It's all part of the challenge of flying.
And it's why it's so important for pilots to have a deep understanding of how these instruments work.
Absolutely.
So they can interpret the information they're getting accurately and make safe decisions.
That's the key to it all.
We've definitely covered a lot of ground in this first part of our deep dive. From the principles of pressure and airflow to the mind-boggling world of gyroscopes and magnetic fields.
It's been quite a journey so far.
It has. But we're not done yet, are we?
Not by a long shot. We've got plenty more to explore.
Okay, so next time, we'll delve even deeper into the intricacies of those compass errors.
And we'll discuss how pilots compensate for them to ensure accurate navigation.
Sounds good to me. So until then, keep your wings level, everyone. Welcome back, everyone. It's time to fire up those engines and continue our deep dive into the fascinating world of flight instruments.
Last time, we left off with those quirky compass errors.
Yeah, those magnetic gremlins that can really mess with the pilot's sense of direction.
Exactly. And today, we're going to unravel those mysteries.
Okay, I'm all ears.
Well, we touched on dip errors last time, remember?
Yeah, that's where the compass needle tilts because of the Earth's magnetic field dipping downwards.
Right. But things get even more interesting when you start making turns.
Okay, how so?
Well, because of that tilt, the compass doesn't always behave the way you might expect.
In what way?
It can either lag behind or overshoot the actual heading change when you're turning.
So it's not just a matter of the compass being off by a few degrees. It could actually give you a false indication of which way you're turning.
Exactly. Mm. And that can obviously be a pretty big problem if you're not careful.
Okay, so break it down for me. What are these northerly and southerly turning errors all about?
Okay, so imagine you're flying along.
Yeah.
And you need to make a turn from a northerly heading.
Okay.
As you start the turn, the compass will tend to lag behind the actual turn.
So it'll show you turning less than you actually are.
Right. And if you're not aware of this, you might end up overshooting your turn.
Turning too far in the wrong direction.
Exactly. Now, on the other hand, if you're turning from a southerly heading, the compass will actually jump ahead.
Oh, wow. So it'll make you think you've turned more than you have.
That's right. So in this case, you might end up undershooting your turn.
Okay, so it's like the compass is playing tricks on you depending on which way you're turning.
That's a good way to put it. It's almost like it has a mind of its own sometimes.
So how do pilots deal with these turning errors? How do they outsmart the compass?
Well, experience definitely plays a big role.
Sure.
Pilots get a feel for how the compass behaves in different situations.
Okay.
But there are also some specific techniques they can use to compensate for these errors.
Like what?
For northerly turns, the rule of thumb is to stop the turn a bit early.
Okay.
Anticipating that the compass is going to lag behind.
Got it.
And for southerly turns, you need to let the compass pass your desired heading slightly before you level off.
Ah, okay. So you're basically overcompensating in both cases to account for the compass's quirks.
Exactly. And the amount you need to adjust depends on your latitude.
Okay. How so?
Well, the closer you are to the poles, the more pronounced these errors become.
Ah, that makes sense. So flying near the equator, these turning errors would be less of an issue.
Exactly. It's all about understanding the relationship between your location, the Earth's magnetic field, and the compass itself.
It sounds like flying with a compass is a delicate dance, requiring a keen understanding of its every move.
That's a great analogy. And just like with any dance, practice makes perfect.
Okay, so we've tackled those pesky turning errors.
We have.
But what about those acceleration errors we talked about earlier?
Yes, those can be tricky too.
They sounded pretty baffling. Remind me how those work again.
Well, it all comes down to the inertia of the compass card.
Okay.
When you accelerate, the card tilts back.
Okay.
And when you decelerate, it tilts forward.
Okay.
And this tilting, combined with the Earth's magnetic field, can make it seem like you're turning.
Even when you're flying straight.
That's right. It can be quite deceptive.
Wow. So even smooth changes in speed can mess with the compass.
They can indeed.
Yeah.
It's just another example of how pilots need to be constantly aware of all the factors that can affect their instruments.
And cross-check their readings regularly.
Absolutely. It's all about building that situational awareness.
Okay, so is there any way to remember these acceleration errors, like a mnemonic or something?
There is, actually. It's a handy little acronym. ANDES.
ANDES.
It stands for Accelerate North, Decelerate South.
Okay, so when you accelerate on a northerly heading, the compass will indicate a turn towards the north.
That's right.
And when you decelerate on a southerly heading, it'll show a turn towards the south.
Exactly. It's a simple way to remember which way the compass is going to misbehave.
Okay, I'll try to keep that in mind. ANDES. It's amazing how mastering the magnetic compass is all about unraveling these intricate interactions between the aircraft's movement, the Earth's magnetic field, and the compass itself.
It really is a fascinating interplay of forces.
Now, we've talked about traditional magnetic compasses, but I understand there's another type of compass that's becoming more common these days.
You're thinking of the vertical card magnetic compass.
That's the one. What's so special about those?
Well, for one thing, they're a lot easier to read.
Okay, how so?
Instead of having a tilting needle, they use a rotating card that stays upright.
Ah, okay, so you don't have to tilt your head to figure out the heading.
Exactly. It's much more intuitive.
And these vertical card compasses are often found in those fancy glass cockpits, right?
They are, yes. They're part of that whole trend towards digital instrumentation.
Okay. Are there any other advantages to these vertical card compasses besides being easier to read?
They do tend to be more stable and reliable than traditional compasses.
Okay, why is that?
Well, they incorporate something called eddy current damping.
Eddy current damping.
It sounds complicated, but it basically helps to reduce oscillations in the compass card.
So it gives you a smoother, more accurate reading.
Exactly. Technology has definitely come a long way in improving the accuracy and reliability of these instruments.
That's good to hear. But even with all these advancements, it's still crucial for pilots to understand the principles behind these compasses and their limitations.
Absolutely. A good pilot is always learning and always striving to improve their understanding of these systems.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground with compasses.
We have. From the basics of magnetic fields to those tricky turning and acceleration errors.
It's amazing how much complexity there is in something that seems so simple on the surface.
It's a reminder that even the most basic instruments have their own quirks and nuances.
Okay, so now that we've mastered the magnetic compass, what's next on our journey through the world of flight instruments?
Well, there's another instrument that's often overlooked, but plays a vital role in understanding the aircraft's relationship with the air around it.
And that is?
The outside air temperature gauge. Or OAT gauge.
The OAT gauge. That sounds pretty straightforward.
It might seem simple at first glance.
Okay.
But the information it provides is crucial for a number of reasons.
Okay. Enlighten me. Why is knowing the outside air temperature so important for a pilot?
Well, for one thing, it's a key factor in calculating density altitude.
Right. We talked about that earlier. The feels-like temperature for airplanes.
Exactly. And remember, density altitude has a huge impact on aircraft performance.
Okay. So the OAT gauge helps pilots understand how their plane is going to handle in different air densities.
Precisely. But it also helps them understand how temperature changes with altitude.
Okay. And how does that come into play?
Well, for example, it can affect engine performance and fuel consumption.
Ah, okay. So even seemingly simple instruments like the OAT gauge are actually providing vital information that pilots need to make informed decisions.
Exactly. It's all about connecting the dots and seeing the big picture.
Speaking of connecting the dots, there's another instrument that I'm really curious about. The angle of attack indicator.
The AOA indicator. Now that's a fascinating one.
I know we've talked about airspeed and altitude, but how is angle of attack different?
Well, airspeed tells you how fast you're moving through the air.
Right.
But angle of attack is all about the wing's orientation relative to the oncoming airflow.
Okay, I think I'm starting to see the distinction.
It's like if you stick your hand out of a car window.
Okay.
If you tilt your hand, you could feel more or less force against it.
Right.
That's basically angle of attack. It's the angle at which the wing is attacking the air.
So a higher angle of attack means more lift, right?
Generally speaking, yes.
Yeah.
But there's a limit to how much you can increase the angle of attack before things start to get dangerous.
Okay, I'm sensing a butt coming. What's the catch? Okay, I'm all ears. Tell me about this angle of attack and why it's so important.
Well, As you increase the angle of attack, you do increase lift, like you said.
Okay.
But you also increase drag.
Ah.
But at a certain point, you reach what's called the critical angle of attack.
Okay.
And that's where things can get a little dicey.
Why? What happens at the critical angle of attack?
Well, the smooth airflow over the wing starts to separate.
Okay.
And you get a sudden loss of lift.
And that's what's called a stall, right?
Exactly. A stall. And stalls can be very dangerous.
I remember reading that they can happen at any airspeed.
That's right. It's not just about how fast you're going.
Okay.
It's about exceeding that critical angle of attack.
So you could be flying along at a seemingly safe speed.
Right.
But if your angle of attack is too high,
you're in trouble.
You could stall.
Yeah.
Okay. That's why this angle of attack thing is so important. So that's where the AOA indicator comes in, right?
Exactly. The angle of attack indicator is like an early warning system for stalls.
Okay, so tell me about this AOA indicator. How does it work?
Well, there are a couple of different types.
Okay.
Some use a little vane.
Okay.
That's mounted on the fuselage.
Okay.
And it rotates as the airflow changes.
Okay.
Others use pressure sensors.
Okay.
To measure the difference in air pressure between the upper and lower surfaces of the wing.
Ah, okay. So it's constantly sensing how the air is flowing over the wing.
Exactly. And if it detects that the angle of attack is getting close to that critical point,
it warns the pilot.
Exactly.
Okay, that's pretty cool. So it's like an extra set of eyes watching out for a potential stall.
That's a great way to put it.
And what's really cool is that it gives you that information regardless of your airspeed or altitude or anything else.
That's right. It's a direct measurement of the wing's angle of attack.
Okay, so the AOA indicator tells you your angle of attack.
Yes.
But how do pilots actually use this information to fly more safely and efficiently?
Well, it has a lot of applications.
Like what?
For example, you can use it to optimize your climb and descent rates.
Okay.
You can also use it to improve fuel efficiency.
Ah, okay. So it's not just about safety.
No, it can definitely help you fly more efficiently as well.
Okay.
But its most important role, without a doubt,
yeah,
is stall awareness and prevention.
Okay.
By keeping an eye on that AOA indicator,
yeah,
pilots can make sure they're operating within a safe range,
okay,
especially during critical maneuvers.
Like what?
Takeoffs, landings, steep turns.
Okay. Those are all times when you really don't want to stall.
Exactly.
So the AOA indicator is basically giving pilots a whole new level of awareness, right?
It is.
It's not just about avoiding stalls. It's about having a deeper understanding of how the wing is behaving.
Exactly. It's like having a direct line of communication with the air itself.
It really is. It's amazing to think about all the information that pilots have at their fingertips these days.
It is. And it's all thanks to the ingenuity of these flight instruments.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive, from the Pitot system to gyroscopic instruments to the intricacies of the magnetic compass and now this amazing angle of attack indicator.
It's been quite a journey.
It has. And I have to say, I've learned a lot. So I want to thank you for being such a fantastic guide.
You're very welcome. I'm always happy to talk about this stuff.
And of course, a huge thank you to all of you out there listening in. We hope you've enjoyed this deep dive into the world of flight instruments as much as we have. And remember, keep exploring, keep learning, and always keep those wings level.